Hello, and welcome to our series, Career Resilience, where we talk with people about their career path and their career journey, and maybe we can all learn from each other. My name is Jan Daniluk, and I'm a human resources professional in London, Ontario, Canada. I work with Fort Keist LLP, and I work with my clients to help them with the HR side of their business. We hope that you will enjoy these discussions with real people about real challenges and real working life situations. Welcome. My guest today is Fred Tomczyk. Fred, I'm so delighted to have you on Career Resilience. Thank you.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here today.
Great. So I'm going to jump right in because I have so many questions to ask you. I feel that you have had a stratospheric career. I've had a good career, but I consider yours as stratospheric. I think in a way we're speaking to a couple of audiences today. One would be an audience that is growing in their career and coming along. And the other would be an audience that's just really interested in hearing about such a successful career as yours. So that's kind of our plan for today. Well, first of all, I do want to ask you, where are you located, Fred?
Well, I have a tendency to move around, but during the COVID time, I'm at our cottage, which is up in the Parry Sound area. We just find it so easy to self-isolate up here. There's very few cases, and so we can feel safer.
Yeah, and that's a beautiful area of Ontario. Mm-hmm. So given the theme of our series, I wanted to ask you, what does career resilience mean to you? How would you describe it?
Well, to me, when I think of career resilience, and I think of resilience, period, it's being able to fight through difficult times or tough times, whether that be in a job, whether that be the economic environment you find yourself in, or whether you find yourself in a period of immense change. And it's that ability you have in your career, in your leadership position, to kind of fight through that and see opportunity as opposed to just freeze and worry about it.
To see opportunity in the downtime, sort of?
Yeah, I agree with that. Particularly, because all my career is in financial services, and when you have downtimes, there's always opportunities. And if you look back at my career, I mean, I've taken advantage of those situations. I mean, first, you obviously have to make sure you're going to get through it. But then you have to sort of face reality and then step up and do what you need to do to find opportunities and take advantage of those.
Fred, are you a cup half full guy?
Yeah, I think so. I always think of, the story of my career, which is probably one of the biggest moments, is when I took over TD Ameritrade as the CEO. I always heard it's a interesting story. I had just come back from a vacation with my family before I was going to take over the job. And my daughter had just got married in Boston, and we were flying back to New York. And so it was my first day as the CEO the next morning. And I got a phone call just before I got on the plane from my predecessor that Merrill Lynch was going down and Lehman Brothers were going down. So you better, when you get home, you better call a management team meeting tonight. And, you know, you got to get through the short term, but, you know, you're in for a rough start here. And so, you know, when you have those types of situations, I took advantage of that. I mean, obviously, the first thing in my mind was getting through the first couple of days and making sure, you know, the company was fine and stable and had good liquidity. But after that, you know, we really did take advantage of that in the situation to go on offense as opposed to play defense.
Interesting. So So let's backtrack. And can you tell me a bit about sort of the Coles notes of your career's steps?
Sure. If I went back, you know, so younger in life, I was a good athlete, and so managed to be lucky enough to get the opportunity to attend Cornell University, where I got my education. And so I managed to get an Ivy League education playing hockey. And, you know, the ability to do both in that kind of an institution was a learning experience in and of itself. Mm-hmm. And then I came out and decided to go in banking. Initially, I was going to go work for what was then Chase Manhattan Bank, but at that time, Jimmy Carter was toughening up immigration law, so I wound up coming back and wound up working with the Bank of Montreal for 2 or 3 years, and then went and got my CA. I decided to get my CA or CPA. So went back to work at Coopers & Lybrand, did that for 3 years till I figured out I really didn't like auditing. But, you know, I was a good finance person. So at that point, I went to London Life. Probably one of the first turning points in my career was at that time when I got there, being a young accountant as a financial analyst, not an accountant per se. They were looking at whether to buy Royal Trust or Canada Trust. So somehow through all that, I got that assignment to do all the analytical work. Okay. And you would remember this, but you know, I was very early stage of the financial modeling that you see so common today in finance and accounting and wherever. That was new back then because it used to be all done by hand. But I taught myself how to do that on an Apple IIe. And so I built this Mammoth models to model the acquisitions, and that's kind of was my first experience to get exposure to very senior executives and demonstrate my abilities. It's one of those things that you're the right person in the right place at the right time. And I never knew how to use a spreadsheet. I had to just stay at night and learn how to do that.
Okay.
And so then I rose up all the way through London Life, and 14 years later, I was the CEO. 2 years after that, 2.5 years after that, the company got sold. So that's when I joined Canada Trust to go back to banking, and then up into TD and vice chair of TD. I ran wealth management for TD. The last step of my career was I became the president's chief executive officer of TD Ameritrade in New York.
Fred, when you were growing up, what did you want to be when you grew up?
Well, in those days, I wanted to be a hockey player, right? I mean, as all young hockey players would be. And I was a pretty good one. Obviously, I managed to get it through U.S. college. Mm-hmm. But I had parents that, always made sure school was a priority and getting an education was important. And so, it was almost like an unwritten rule in the house. You couldn't choose hockey without the education. So, and in fact, I was, asked to play junior A when I was 15 years old. And I had to decline because at that time I had 3 universities in the U.S. already talking to me.
You said you had to decline. Was that easy to do?
No, it wasn't easy because at the time they allowed me to practice with them. And so I practiced with them for the better part of a month. And then what they did was they said, okay, come on in on Saturday morning. And they had my stuff all packed up and on the bus and say, okay, we're going to Toronto to play the Marlies. And so it was like, they put me in a difficult spot. And my father wasn't very happy how they did that, but I had the wherewithal to sort of say, no, I'm not doing that. I've decided I'm going to go to U.S. college instead.
How do you think your hockey mind and career shaped the kind of executive you became? What effect did that have on you?
I think it had a big effect. I think it teaches you a number of good characteristics. I think one is being on a team, learning how to be part of a team, to play your role, to help out others. The benefits of hard work, fighting through injuries. And I think, dealing with pressure, because I think when you play at that level, and I was always the guy that was on the ice in the last, 2 minutes of the game of a close game or killing penalties. So you learned, perseverance and discipline. You learn to be resilient and, to deal with it. And it brought you a certain sort of perseverance that you don't see in a lot of people.
Did you use your elbows a lot, Fred?
I think people would probably say that, not intentionally, but it was just the way it worked.
Okay. So then there you are, you're working away, you're earning an income, you're at BMO, What made you decide to go in the direction of a CA?
Well, I was married at the time, and two things happened. One, I kept, not unlike what we talked about earlier in the preamble, which is they moved me around a lot, and I became a problem solver. So, in a very short period of time, I got moved three times, and every time I fixed one problem, they moved me to a nastier problem. And so, it was a lesson. And it's not that much that I mind fixing problems, but in those days when you worked in banking and in the branch system, which I did, you were moving 20 to 30 times in your career. And, I was married, we were going to have a family, and that's not something I wanted to do. So, and we had customers that, were courting me to become a CA. And so it was something that intrigued me. And the more research I did, the more I thought, well, that's kind of like, as opposed to getting an MBA, I could work while I was getting sort of an MBA in finance and accounting. That was the thought process.
Mm-hmm. And you chose CA because it seemed like a more practical route, or?
Well, there was money involved, but I think it was, you could call it practical, but I think it was, my orientation was finance and accounting and math in any way. And clearly, one of the things, I've always told younger people is, if you could figure out what you like to do, you're probably good at it. And so I happened to be good, particularly at finance and accounting. And so I decided that was the path I was going to go. Even if I wanted to get an MBA, it was probably going to major in math and finance, finance and accounting.
Okay. When did you realize, or maybe you were even told, that you were this high potential person?
I was probably told, although you had some inklings. And I think when I was, the big change for me was when I was at London Life and I did the financial modeling on Royal Trust versus Canada Trust. Mm-hmm. I did, and then went into corporate development, and they liked me to do that for all of their acquisitions and potential acquisitions. So I did that, but then I wound up in a more traditional controller type job with the group division of London Life. And there, the guy that was my boss at the time told me, look, you could easily be the CFO of London Life on your current course and speed. Like that's not, but we think you've got more potential than that. And we'd like you to move out of finance. You may have some finance related activities, but we'd like you to move into general management. And so that was kind of a point where I was maybe 32 or 33 years old at that time. Mm-hmm. And so that was a big change for me. And that told me, okay, well, maybe there is something beyond just finance and accounting.
For you or in life?
Well, I think they go hand in hand. One of the things you always worry about, at least I worried about, was getting bored with what you were doing. Later on, one of the reasons I went back to banking as opposed to staying in life insurance, because I could have. I mean, other life insurers had offered me big jobs when we were sold. Was I couldn't see myself spending 30 plus years just in the life insurance industry. Mm-hmm. And so I decided to go back to banking because it was a lot more areas in banking was more interesting to me. And then the thought of the time that was eventually, the various pillars of financial services would come together and I'd be one of the few executives that had a high level experience in both life insurance and in the banking business. And so that was one of the things. But to me, it was always about, sort of learning and growing and developing and trying different things and never getting sort of stale or bored in a job or a slot.
Would you ever get to a stage, Fred, where you would say to yourself, I think I'm a little bit stale, I think I'm a little bit bored? Would you ever actually get to that stage before the next thing happened?
I think so. I became a senior vice president at London Life at 32. And so I always had, interesting jobs, but, you could get stale. There's no question. And I think there's probably a few points in my career. London Life moved me along so fast that, I never got bored. But certainly when I was at TD, I was the vice chairman for Ed Clark, his number two, four, 5 years. And in his mind, that was great because, you know, I ran just about all the corporate functions other than finance and corporate development. You know, so for him, I took all the, a lot of the day-to-day problems of the bank and the issues of the bank office desk. But for him, and he could go work on things, you know, were important, you know, like strategy and M&A transactions and leadership and things like that. But for me, I couldn't, I used to say to him, I can't do this for the rest of my career. I mean, you know, it's not that I'm bored, but, you know, I don't think I can do this for the rest of my career. And I don't think it's actually good for the organization for me to do this for the rest of my career.
Is that when you made the move to Ameritrade?
Yeah. And that's when he decided to put me into Ameritrade.
And how boring did you ever find that?
You know, Ameritrade never got boring because you were working in the States, which is very different than Canada. It was a company that had, it was a good company, but it had a lot of opportunities for change and transformation. And you worked in an industry that was very dynamic. And you were, because, you know, we were an investment firm or a brokerage house, but we were also internet-based, which meant that you were on the forefront of what how the world was evolving. So you never really got bored because you were, you know, right in the middle of what you see today with Amazon and all that stuff. Not in the same way as them, but you were doing a lot of the same things, experimenting with a lot of the same techniques. So you never really got bored there.
No, I wouldn't think so. What was it like to be an executive in the U.S. versus an executive in the Canadian pond?
It's very different, and most people don't believe it until they actually experience it. Because they would say it's the same, and I would say, no, it's not. The industries that I was involved with, whether it's life insurance or banking, or you can even look at telecom, cable, but most Canadian companies tend to operate in industries that have a limited number of players that are very big. And so they have an oligopolistic tendency. So they have this tendency to have a low aversion for risk. They protect their margins. They all think alike. They all act alike. And nobody's sort of hammering on price, as so to speak. So it's kind of I'll call it a rational competition. But let's, you know, all recognize we're all making a lot of money here. And so when you go to the U.S., you get your eyes open. And I find in Canada, a lot of communication at senior levels is more nuanced as opposed to direct. When you go to the U.S., it's all out competition. It's competitive destruction, and it's aggressive. The aversion to risk is much lower. The appetite to take risk and take a chances is much higher. And it's very much... you may be friends with, you know, somebody that's a competitor of yours, but the reality is, you know, it's very much, you know, don't take it personally. It's just about money and capitalism. And you either continue to adapt and change and be aggressive, or you get killed. And it's just a very different competitive environment and sort of appetite for risk. I found that is just very, very different.
Were you surprised by that, or had you been prepped for that?
No, going to school in the U.S. and having friends in the U.S., I had some appreciation for it. But I think where it may have been more obvious to me when I got inside of Ameritrade, because I was there for a year before I became the CEO to clean up some issues they had from the integration of Waterhouse and Ameritrade. I kind of knew what I was going to do, but I had been prepped for it. The thing there's, you know, there's the U.S. versus Canada with Ameritrade, but it's Ameritrade versus TD. And I used to always tell Ed Clark and the board, I said, you have to understand, we're not TD down here. TD, you know, most people don't know what it is. And we're a national firm. At that time, we're just in the Northeast and not really a dominant banking name. And the same thing is, you know, we're the little guy punching up. You know, we weren't the big guy looking down on the little guy. We were essentially disruptors of Merrill Lynch and Morgan Stanley. That's really what we were, and an e-commerce type firm. So it's just very different running it. And you have to think different, you have to act different, you have to make decisions different than you would if you were at a TD Bank in Canada.
And when you were there, did you ever think this isn't going to work? Do you ever sort of have those dips where you think, oh my God?
When I took over, certainly I walked into the crisis, Merrill Lynch and Morgan Stanley and the Great Recession. So I kind of walked into that. And it became obvious to me very quick. There were, 95% of our revenue was tied to equity trading commissions. And equity traders, when you have that kind of an environment where there's a market crash, they stop trading. So right away, a lot of our revenue was at risk. It was going to go down substantially. And the part that I think the board and the previous management missed was the other 45%, 47% of our revenue was in interest sensitive assets. And so all of a sudden, interest rates came way down. Mm. And so we lost, the other side got crushed. So we essentially lost all of our earnings. If you could model it out and look it out, which we did, we said, okay, well, unless we change things here, we're going to, we're going to start losing money here. But we didn't have any balance sheet issues. So it was one of those situations where you kind of go, whoa, now what do I do? And it wasn't a time to, act like you were at TD because, TD owned 40%, you were an independent public company. Your stock traded on exchanges. You had other shareholders, some of them bigger shareholders. And so it was, I had to do something. And at the time, the whole organization was, saying, okay, we're just going to start to cut expenses until we can't take it anymore. In that environment, that's where I saw opportunity. And I did have a strategy in my head that, people didn't quite know at the time. But at that first year, I had developed it. Mm. And we decided to go on offense. Talk about being in the U.S. and being aggressive. We increased our marketing spend from $140 million a year to $300 million a year over 2 years, and decided to become an asset gatherer. We changed how we managed client cash because interest rates are so low. We'd made an acquisition in the option trading space, a company in Chicago, and we took the option industry by surprise. And so we became the firm that basically became the most aggressive to try and take advantage of the situation and attacked Morgan Stanley and Merrill Lynch even harder, who at that time, their brands were damaged. They were on their backs. They were just trying to survive. Yeah. And we took advantage of that. But when I looked at it, it was a little scary.
Yeah. And fascinating at the same time. Are you a command and control type leader, or describe your leadership approach?
I would call it much more situational. I think there's a time to be collaborative. There's a time to listen and bring people together. But there's also times to be more directive. I would have never said command and control. But like the example I just described at Ameritrade, when you're in that crisis and everybody's scared and worried and like a deer in the headlights, it is a time for the leader to step up and be actually glass half full, but also be directive. Mm-hmm. It's not a time to sort of say, well, what do you think we should do here? You had to make decisions quick and you had to be very directive and forceful.
Yeah. I want to ask you a question around ruthlessness. When you're a leader at the kind of level that you are a leader, is ruthless part of the equation?
Some people would say it is. I don't believe that. There will always, in a big organization, be some people that happen to have that point of view. And it can be problematic in an organization, but I don't think there's a place, particularly in today's world, for being a ruthless leader. I think where you probably are harsher, and one of the advice I got when I was a young executive was, you can have differences of opinion on strategy, and ways that you do things, but you can have differences of opinion on values. And so if there's an area where you're quite, you may call it ruthless, I would call it you're very black and white, is on values. And when people clearly break values and you can't agree on changing the person's behavior, then you have to be, you might call it ruthless, because you can't run an organization if you don't have values that you're willing to stand up for and demonstrate that, you know, that you cannot disobey or break those values and continue to survive here.
So it's important that your values are aligned with the organization and with the strategy and where we're all sort of rowing together.
That's right.
Yeah. How did you handle problem employees in terms of people that were offside? Were you pretty quick at that, or, you know, lots of chances kind of guy, or how did you approach that?
Well, it depended what it was, and in some cases who it was. If there was a person who was a good performer, had some respect in the organization, you would give them second chances, maybe even third chances, and try to move them along. But definitely have a discussion with them. The first one might be a friendly discussion about, the second one might be more direct. But after the third one, you have to be very direct, and you either change it or you're leaving.
Yeah.
One of the things that really bothered me, and probably the people that I got most irate with, were very senior people that, as I would call, had this tendency to yell and scream and berate junior people, particularly junior women. In today's world, I just have zero tolerance for that. And I did have executives that did that. And when I heard about it, I quickly confronted that. And if I heard about it again, then they were gone. Because it can kill a culture, particularly when you're trying to promote diversity and inclusion in your organization. You can't have people that, you know, have that need to demonstrate their authority through power and verbal abuse.
Mm-hmm. So if you had that type of scenario, and I've certainly seen it and lived it, and I've seen executives throw furniture and all the rest of it, was that immediately gone, or was that that first, second, third kind of conversation?
Depends how severe it was. Normally with me, it would go to the third conversation. If I ever hear about this again, you're out of here. I mean, there's just, and I had a particular hot button for senior people that had to have that kind of behavior over more junior staff who were afraid of them. It was just one of those things that I just had zero tolerance for.
Mm-hmm. And I think, of course, that all ties back to values. That would hardly be one of the values of any organization. And yet, so many of us have seen it and learned it. And lived it, I should say, lived it. And you just think, wow, that's just so amazing that the organization is willing to put up with behavior that's so unacceptable. Do you think, Fred, that we've come a long way?
I think we've come a long way, but I think we have a long way to go. Mm-hmm. I think it's getting much better, but it's still in organizations and even on boards, because I sit on a couple of boards, getting them to sort of embrace diversity and actually think through how they're going to change their organization. And what I call the difference between diversity and inclusion. Mm-hmm. And it's not just about hitting a number. Mm-hmm. I always remember when we started at TD, everybody just said, tell me what my goal is and leave me alone. Ed and I were very hard on that, saying, no, it's not just about a goal. It's much more than that. That doesn't mean we don't measure it, but it's not a goal that you hit and it goes away and you go back to normal. It's a forever thing, and it's a way of how you sort of bring in people from outside, how you develop people, how you include people in discussions and decisions. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of things. And it's one of those things that I think we still got a long, long way to go.
As you were going through your career, did you always have a coach or a mentor, or were you your own coach and mentor?
A little bit of both. I never had what I would call a formal coach or mentor, but I had people that would always stay close to me and regularly talk to me, whether it's about career or what was going on. And when I was at London Life, it was the head of human resources just took a, because of the potential they saw in me, he took a particular interest in always spending time with me. So we would, you know, we would always have a coffee together in the morning, probably two or three times a week, just to talk about things. And so, you know, in some ways he mentored me, there's no question. But, you know, and, but outside of that, it was much more just, you know, me. And I think one of the things I did a lot was to get out and listen to people and talk to people, whether that's frontline people, more junior people. I think you learn a lot when you listen more than you talk.
Yes. Now I'm going to ask you, behind every great man, there is a great woman. So tell me about how your home life and your wife helped you in your career.
Well, I could bring her in here and she'll tell you that I'd be nothing without her. But, and there's a great video of Nick Saban, the coach of the Alabama Crimson Tide. If you ever, I should find it and forward it to you about how it was really all his wife. But anyways, you know, I had a great family life, a great wife who was supportive through all that, because you're working a lot of hours. I mean, if you're going to do what I did, it's not a 9-to-5 job. And unfortunately for her, with me, it means I rarely shut down, and I'm always thinking. And in fact, some of my best thinking would come, you know, first thing in the morning, just as you're kind of waking up, or in the middle of the night. So, but, you know, she was very supportive and, you know, looked after the home life a fair bit, helped, did more than her fair share with the kids and at home to give me the time to do things. But she, as the kids got older, it became, you know, when you're the CEO of a company like London Life, you know, you're in that business because a lot of the agents work at night. Your spouse becomes a part and part of the organization. So, she had a role to play too, not just being the person at home, but also to be my wife at work and to go to conferences and different things like that.
But her job was within the home?
For the most part. Yeah.
And, yeah. I see that as such a challenge today when, mm-hmm. and I'm sure you do as well, when women are trying to, you know, have equal careers and you sort of, you know, think how would we have done that if she had had the same kind of career I had, you know?
It's hard. It's very hard. In fact, I don't know how certain people do it. You have to have lots of help and a support system around you. Mm-hmm. Because you can't do it, you know, without that. And even in our situation, we always had, you know, lots of friends and, you know, and who were always helpful. Like when our kids played hockey or whatever, mm-hmm. there was always somebody there to take them if I happened to be tied up or whatever.
Yeah. That's the thing. It's all exciting and it's all interesting. It's trying to just build it into your life, isn't it?
Yeah.
What did you always like to do extracurricularly when you were doing all these difficult jobs?
You know, I played hockey, you know, pretty good hockey till I was in my 40s. But then when I became the CEO of London Life, it just became, and I was coaching my son's hockey team, it became unmanageable. So something had to go, so it had to go. I've always managed to exercise in one way, shape, or form. And that was always my way to sort of, it was my solace, is the way I sort of got out of it. And in fact, even today, you know, during the pandemic, and we're going to be up here in Parry Sound, I bought myself a Peloton bike. And one of the things I didn't get about it, I thought it was just riding a bike. but you know, to go on there and get into class and listen to the music and have somebody just lead you, and you really just don't think, you just kind of get into it. It's a way to get a break from all the other stresses of life, I think.
Are you saying different from hopping on just an ordinary stationary bike?
Yeah, no, it is. Because you know, I was doing the elliptical or whatnot, but I would always be watching CNBC. So even when I'm working out, I'm kind of working. Whereas with the Peloton, I'm not working.
Oh.
I'm one of those people that's always thinking, which my, you know, my wife would tell you is her biggest criticism on me, which is whenever I'm sitting there and she's talking to me and I'm not really there acknowledging things, it's because I'm thinking about something.
Yes, that can be very annoying. It can be even annoying for you, I'm sure. You just want to turn it off occasionally, right?
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. I know that somehow when I feel about if I'm watching something on Netflix, I think, oh my gosh, this is so great. I'm not thinking. I love this.
Yeah. No, I have that. I have that problem severely. Yeah. It's always something going through my mind.
Yeah. Are you a reader?
Yes.
And what do you like to read?
You know, when I was younger, I read a lot of psychology books because as I started to manage people more and more and lead people more and more, you know, people that I talked to that I respected, they were saying, you know, don't just read business books and the latest idea. Read stuff that helps you understand people and how to manage and lead people, how people behave and those types of things. So I found that enlightening and fascinating. And then secondly, you know, and probably the last, you know, 10, 20 years, I've read a lot more biographies of popular, you know, people that were great leaders. Like I just read a book, you know, Delano Roosevelt during his times. And when you see the kind of things that he fought through, you kind of, it helps you put things in perspective and gives you motivation to, you know, continue on and fight through things.
Do you believe, Fred, that rough times make us stronger?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, to me, you know, you either buck up and deal with it or you wilt away. And I always, when I was in a leadership position at, you know, TD or London Life or Ameritrade, I would always say it's during difficult times is when you see your best people. It's also when you see your worst people. You know, it's just one of those things that, you know, your best people always tend to rise and show up during those times. And I always remember that from my hockey days. You know, we had guys that would score 3 or 4 goals against the weak teams, but then against the best teams, you know, they were nowhere to be found and different players would step up. And so just it was an eye opener for me.
I do find it fascinating that people who have been involved in team sports really have added quite a dimension to their understanding of the world.
I think I having been somebody that did that most of his life, I would say yes. I mean, it certainly molded my thinking about the way you compete, the way you behave, the way you work on a team, the way you relate to other people. Because reality is when you're on a team, I mean, you may not always like every one of your teammates, but you have to work with them and you have to play with them. And you have to, you know, do your part. There's a game plan and all that stuff. And so you have to, it teaches you certain skills that I'm not sure you get in individualistic sports to the same degree.
Yeah. Okay, I want to get close to wrapping up. I have a couple of final questions for you. One would be, what 3 pieces of advice would you give to someone who's growing in their career right now?
The first one is to figure out what you like to do and do it. I've seen way too many people aspire to a job or a level in an organization, get there, and then just hate that job and watch them sort of grow old in a very short period of time. And then fail. And so if leadership's not your thing or leading a large group of people is not your thing, I mean, that's okay. But then don't aspire to that. Aspire to be the best you can at whatever specialty or orientation you decide you want to do. Mm-hmm. And if you like it, I'll guarantee you it won't feel like work and you'll be good at it.
Yeah.
And you know, whether it's human resources or whether it's finance or whatever. Mm-hmm. The second One is, and I got this advice when I was very young at London Life, was when you're young, you always take experience over money. So don't aspire just to get the highest paying job and jump from job to job. Look for ways to develop yourself around your experience set out, because later in life, when you get more senior, you're going to need those experiences. You just may not realize it today, but you will need them and you will use them. And so the more things you see, different sort of departments or things from different perspectives, the better off you'll be later when you become more senior. And then third, and I've learned this one, you know, after my career at London Life, and I even saw it in banking, is and sort of Ameritrade taught it to me, which is, you know, look at, you know, people look at trends in business or in the economy or whatever. Look for what I call the secular trends, and find ways to go with them and not fight them. Try to find ways to get opportunities that sort of go into those spaces as opposed to in the old comfortable spaces. So whether it's the embracing of the internet or keeping a career agency life insurance sales force, or it's a bank branch versus web banking, or Ameritrade, you know, it was, you know, do you want to continue to be a broker at Merrill Lynch, or do you want to move into the internet side and what's called the RIA space in the US? And so, you know, to me, what I learned is that when you go with the secular trends, it just seems like over time, the wind is at your back. And if you don't, it feels like the wind is in your face all the time.
And how do you know what the secular trends are?
Well, you have to think about that. And that's one of the things of, I say, is missed in most strategic thinking in companies, which is to sort of look at all those trends and to deliberately and methodically split them between those two. But obviously in today's world, you know, e-commerce is a secular trend. I mean, anybody sort of fighting that trend right now is going to be on the losing end of the game. That type of stuff, you know, mobile is first, all that kind of stuff is just, it's the way it is, and you've got to go with it. You can't fight it.
Okay, so secular trend is kind of like the wind in your sails as you're going along. Yeah.
It just makes business and your career a whole lot easier than sort of fighting it to protect your bottom line forever. It never works in the long term. It's just a question of when you're going to have to deal with it.
Yeah. So my final question is, which has to be a different answer from what you just gave, because that might figure in, but what advice would you give to an executive listening to us right now about how to make the biggest impact in their organization when their organization is fighting them?
Well, I think, you know, that's, to me, is to learn the disciplines of change management. And I had to learn that lesson at London Life, because it was an old career agency life insurance company that was very stuck in its ways and was very resistant to change. And so there are books on that, but there are models to it. And one of the first things you have to do is to establish, well, you know, to people, well, why do we need to change? You know, and until people accept that we may need to change, they're not going to change. And then you have to sort of work at it. And the model I have always followed, because I've led a lot of change, is to establish the need for change. Secondly, to if you work with a small group of people that buy into that. And then the mistake most people do then is they try to tackle on the biggest, hardest change first. You need to take on some early wins to build momentum, that you got demonstrations of success, because everyone else is looking for evidence of failure, and then work up to your much bigger changes and then launch them. But you also, and whenever, you know, when I changed it at Ameritrade or when at TD, I used to have a saying, you say, you are what you measure, manage, and reward. And too often people would articulate and communicate a change, but not change what you measured, what you managed, or what you rewarded. And I think to pay attention to that, because, you know, if you change the measurement system, people will change. But you have to change that measurement system.
Hmm. That is interesting. That is so helpful. Mm-hmm. Is there any final thing you'd like to say?
No, the only other thing I would say to a young executive, and I've seen this more so in the banking industry, the big banks in Canada, is that, you know, complexity is not your friend, and, you know, simplicity is. And so when you're running a big organization or you have a big area, try to, you know, when you laid out your strategy or what you're trying to do, you only can make 3 to 5 points. So keep it simple, consistent, and on point, and align your measurement systems with them. Because if you make it a complicated thing, people don't know what to do. And organizations work best when it's clear what to do, and it's clear how you're measuring how it's working or not working.
And tying it all back to values.
Yep. Well, values to me are sort of, regardless of strategy, you have to have a value system in an organization, any big organization, because if you don't, any behavior is acceptable, and that can lead to chaos.
And on that note, thank you so much for chatting with me today.
Oh, you're welcome. It was my pleasure.
Thanks, Fred. And to our viewers and listeners, thanks for joining Fred and me today. Lots to think about in our discussion, and I'll be digesting it as we go forward. Thank you for joining us. I hope that you will find me on LinkedIn and connect with me. Listen for my podcast wherever you get your podcast, and you can also watch us on YouTube. So as well, I wanted to mention to you that I have a new website up called career-resilience.com. That is career-resilience.com. And I'm also blogging on that website with How to Be Amazing at Work. That's the name of the blog. So I hope that you will take a look. So thanks for joining us, and until we meet again.